I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Probably the moment of the season thus far, and there have been some good ones, some surprising ones, but seeing the manager in the laundry basket being pushed through the shower.
A lot of fun.
One of the great moments of anyone's career, and we are delighted to welcome in Will Venable. He joins us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire. Check them out at aturo.com. Good morning, Will. How you doing?
Doing great. Good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing well.
It's been a surprise thus far, and we're really enjoying the way the team has been playing. You know, we were talking amongst ourselves about what your strength would be, and we were unsure. And here you are, first time through the rotation, and I think the conclusion is that it's starting pitching, that you've really had some great starting pitching, and congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. These guys have done a great job, and yeah, you're right. Our identity is kind of revealing itself here in the early going, and obviously pitching is been the highlight of these first few games. So we know pitching and defense is going to be what we have to lean on throughout this season, and happy to see those guys have good results.
Let's go into last night, because Shane Smith was out there and again gave you five scoreless. Just wonder what the thought process was as you were sitting there and he was in the dugout after five scoreless. Going back out, giving him a chance to pitch the six, where was he in terms of his pitch count, which was pretty low, I think, and he probably felt pretty good. And then, Will, it seemed like his velocity dipped, and he got into some trouble with command. Take us through what you were thinking as you were sending him out again in the sixth.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, he did an amazing job for a big league debut to have his composure be what it was, and him really overpowering these guys with a fastball was great. And kind of where all our starters were at kind of going into this first start was, you know, six innings, 100 pitches, and these guys hadn't yet got to six up. So as he got through five and we think about the sixth inning, we felt really good about where the pitch count was, but we were going to be ready with somebody behind him. And, you know, he got those first two quick outs and then the two walks, and it was kind of time to move on, and he had done his job for the day.
Did Penn Murphy have enough time to warm up? It felt like, just watching the game, that happened awful quick. You know, I thought he actually had a strike out there, and then they walk a guy, then the second walk, and then you got to move, and you go out there, and it seemed like you were trying to take your time going out there. Maybe that's just me, but and then when he came in, it wasn't like they hit him with great velocity or anything, but man, that lead disappeared, and the earned run streak was gone. It just was kind of extraordinary how quickly it happened.
Yeah, it was, and Penn was ready to go. We're not going to put these guys in a position out there if they're not ready. Mm-hmm. Did stall and try and give him a couple more pitches there, but they had called down and confirmed that he was ready to go. And, you know, Penn's one of our guys and just wasn't able to bury that slider on France and kind of opened up from there. But, we have a ton of confidence in Penn. You know, if that situation happens again, we're confident that he's going to go out there and get the job done.
Talking with White Sox manager Will Venable here on The Score. Well, one thing that I've been struck by, whether it's at spring training or as the season has gotten off to an encouraging start, is when your players talk about the relationship with the new manager, you, the communication is always referenced. And I also think that it seems like a lot of players respect the fact that you are somebody who is an ex-player and can relate to what they're going through. In your communication with these guys, how often do you lean on that to communicate? And how often does that come up just in a day-to-day routine on the job?
Yeah, it's in everything that we're doing here. You know, having been in their shoes and understanding what it's like and how tough it is, you know, at the end of the day, all you really want as a player is transparency, you know, and I've told these guys, I've said it several times to them, you know, I'm going to mess up a lot of stuff, but the one thing that I'm confident that I'm going to get right is just being honest and transparent with them the best I can, and I know that that's something that they appreciate.
You know, it's been fun to watch your team and to see you get, you know, we didn't know what to expect. And it feels like you have a great understanding of the game. And, you know, when you put your lineup out, I'm looking at the leadoff guy and I'm thinking, oh boy, boom goes the dynamite and he hits a home run. I just think you're making some clever moves and congratulations on that. It's really fun to watch.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, you know, we try to do our best to put these guys in the best situation to succeed. And then it's really up to them. And these guys have been doing a great job from day one of spring training. You know, we've had a plan here. These guys have gone out and worked their tails off. And it's nice to see in the early going here that it's paying off for them.
I like the transparency in that the approach to the batting order is fluid and flexible, and you kind of are looking for something, but you don't know quite yet what you're looking for. And there might be a variety of different options. What are you looking for at the top of the order, and how flexible do you think you can be with the order? That a lot of guys like the routine, they like to have an everyday lineup, but at the same time, when you have a lot of guys that maybe are unproven, you know that's going to be maybe more fluid than you might want it to be.
Yeah, and we want to be sensitive to that. You know, Miguel Vargas comes to mind where we've asked him to lead off. We've asked him to hit fifth. You might see him hit fourth at some point here coming up. And, you know, at the same time, we have to be flexible a little bit. You know, we need to string together as many good things in a row as we can. And I think that just looks different on different nights.
It's fun that Andrew Benintendi has started pretty quick here. And I think that, you know, there was concern with his hand, that's a very tough injury, and yet here he is, and he's raking a little bit. Did you expect him to be able to come back and contribute as quickly as he has?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, and I thought about that yesterday, actually, you know, where we're at in spring training with the hand, thinking that we might be you know, a couple weeks into the season before he was ready to go. And then all of a sudden, you know, he is looking like he is ready to go, but does he have enough at-bats? And then you watch him get in there and take his at-bats, and it's just a reminder that this guy's a really good hitter, you know, and really happy with his start and really happy that he's in the lineup for us.
Sean Burke back on the mound today after a very promising opening day start. He is somebody that you tabbed as the opening day starter, and I think it surprised a lot of people. I'm not sure how surprised you were by what he delivered on opening day, but did it affect the way you viewed him? Can you remind us what his potential is? Because Sean Burke's somebody that suddenly looks like a guy that knows what he's doing out there.
Yeah, you know, it really wasn't surprising at all. You know, watching the way that he worked, really watching all our guys work, you just have a lot of confidence in their process and how they're looking at it, their ability to go out there and execute, and just their confidence. You know, these guys are young guys that are extremely confident in their skill sets, and it's been great to watch them go out there and do it. And with Sean in particular, you know, for me, I'm just learning all of these guys, but it really struck me from day one that this is a guy that really feels like he belongs at the front of a rotation, and we're glad that he is.
So, Will, I'm a lifelong Sox fan, and I'm following your team closely. And I, you know, the minute I hear something like Kyle Teal is raking in the mud, I'm like, bring the guy up. And I just wonder how do you handle the knowledge that there are guys on the way that you got to keep half an eye on, guys that almost made the team. Nothing better than someone named Montgomery showing up at some point. How do you handle that when you got a game and you got to work and you got no time for distraction?
Yeah, you know, we are focused on what's going on here in Chicago, and there's certainly a lot of things going on a daily basis that we're concentrated on here. At the same time, those guys are going to be a part of this, and You know, we sent them to the minor leagues with a game plan, with things that, we wanted them to work on. And we're going to check on those things, and those are going to be kind of our benchmarks moving forward here to see how they're developing and progressing. And, you know, like I said, they're going to be a part of this. And, you know, when their time comes, we'll be ready to go.
So how difficult was it from day one, from the first game, from getting your vantage point at the rate in the dugout, where you're going to sit, what you're going to do, who's sitting next to you, how tied up are you in the rituals and superstitions and just the overall routine? As the manager, was that difficult to get, or how much fun was it to get into that routine?
Yeah, a lot of fun, you know. Number one, trying not to be superstitious here in the early going, you know, and attaching ourselves to all these little things that pop up, even though naturally, I think as baseball players, you end up wanting to do those things. But, you know, I'm just really happy with our staff and kind of our process here in the early going where, you know, whether we're on offense or defense, you know, we're all huddled up. We're talking about stuff. We have great communication. We're being proactive with it. And it's just a really fun process to be a part of, and really happy with the way our staff has gone about it.
I loved your answer to the question about the torpedo bat. That seems to have taken on a life of its own. And you said a lot of the hits you had, a lot of the non-hits would go off the middle of the bat. You wish you had one of those ones.
Yeah, I really could have used that with all the times I got jammed. But yeah, you know, the torpedo bats are interesting. I know that there's a lot of conversation about it. You know, for me, at the end of the day, it's still a round bat, and it's still going to be extremely challenging to hit. So, you know, hey, good for these guys if they're comfortable using those bats, and it gives them confidence up there.
You hit 22 homers in 2013. That was the only year you topped 20 in 13 or 9 years in the majors. Was that the torpedo bat season?
That might have been the 1 year I didn't need the torpedo bat. You know, things were working that year. I was able to get the sweet spot to the ball more often. But yeah, wasn't able to repeat that one. But happy to be able to mix one of those in.
What are you looking for in your lineup? Whether regardless of who's leading it off, and regardless of who else is in it, how would you describe the overall offensive philosophy when guys are going up to the plate?
Yeah, well, we want to control the zone, number one. You know, I think there's a combination of controlling the zone and being ready to attack on pitches that we can do damage on. And these guys have done a great job, you know, starting with our hitting coaches and their advanced process and highlighting, you know, the game plan attack for each one of these pitchers that we're facing. And then our guys going out and training and getting ready for those moments. And then, you know, going out there on the field and executing. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it's going to be about. It's going to be about controlling the zone and not missing the pitches in the zone that you can hit.
You know, I got to tell you, I love the way that we now look at the White Sox and we think somebody knows a lot about pitching. Like, someone there is doing a great job because these guys, you know, guys like Cannon didn't get it done in Arizona. But he comes to Chicago and, oh, yeah, that was because of the weather in Arizona. Like and it's a logical answer, and it feels that way. And I believe it was Shane Smith, and you were asked, what do you tell a guy when he's making his debut? You're like, well, I'm not the one that's in his head. I'm not the one in his ear. You let other pitchers, you let other guys help him out as he's starting off as a starting pitcher. I just think that's very wise. Is that from your years of playing yourself, when people would get in your head or tell you something, is it better to come from players?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some messages that need to come from the manager, but things like that, we just have a really good pitching program, number one, and we have really good players that are good teammates, you know? And so there's a lot of support that each player needs. It doesn't always have to come from the manager, and more often than not, it's better when it comes from teammates.
I think one of the all the starts from your five guys in your rotation have been impressive for different reasons. I think the one that may stand out, it's hard to pick one, but Martin Perez did what he did by not topping 90, I think, velocity-wise. So he definitely is the definition of a pitcher. He wasn't just a thrower. He was finding and locating and doing the things that 34-year-old veterans have been known to do. How impressive have you been by Martin Perez, not only what he has done on the mound since arriving, but also he's talking very optimistically and setting a very positive tone in that clubhouse.
Yeah, I'm absolutely in love with what Martin is doing, you know. And like you said, it's obviously the performance on the mound speaks for itself, but it's a communication with his teammates. We believe that we have the opportunity to create our own weather here and create the environment that is conducive to us playing good baseball and winning, and Martin is contributing to that at a very high level. And so when he's talking optimistically about this group, I love it. You know, it's you know, for us not to put a ceiling on what we can do here is very important. And I think at the end of the day, when you have that kind of conversation from a leader like that, it really gives our guys the confidence that, you know, we can go out and win this game today.
You know, I heard, I think it was Steve Stone on the broadcast said that with Martin Perez in particular, his hands, when they're down at his waist before he gets going, he's more comfortable in that position. And they had noticed, I think it was Brian Bannister had noticed maybe, that he was holding the ball up higher to his chest, and that was one of the slight adjustments. And I think when we hear things like that, we think about the way you've come in and you understand analytics and you're looking at the game differently, and there are these little things, tiny adjustments that make a huge difference for players, and you're trying to do that throughout the roster.
Yeah, you know, that's a huge part of this. You know, all these little things matter, and, you know, they can make a really big impact. And, you know, that's why we feel confident about our group of coaches, how we've structured our departments and the work that they've been doing, that, you know, there's these things that we notice and we can make adjustments with. And then, you credit the players for being able to make those adjustments, train, and then take them into the game and have success.
So we talk to Ozzie every week, and you know he's ever present at the ballpark, especially now that the studio's on the fourth floor. He's going to be out there all the time. He told us about giving you a bottle of champagne after your first major league victory. Have you popped the cork yet?
Yeah, I have popped the cork, and just so appreciative of Ozzie and his support. You know, that bottle of champagne came with a really nice note that really meant a lot. And you know, whether it's Ozzie or you know, everybody else that's showing me love and support here, just makes me feel really good and feel like I'm in a really good spot with this club.
Well, speaking of being in a really good spot, you gotta answer the question: have you tried the birthday cake milkshake, and how do you compare it to the campfire milkshake?
No, I have not. I have not got down on milkshakes yet. I need to try those.
Well, the best news is, Will, is that, you know what, this year it looks like the baseball will be just as good as the food at the rate. So that's encouraging.
Great.
No, it's awesome. Yeah, no, thanks, guys. We're excited to get going here, and appreciate you guys.
We really appreciate it. Thanks, Will. Have a great game today. Hopefully the weather holds up.
Good luck, Will.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Take care.
That's Will Venable, the manager of the Chicago White Sox.
I hope they get the game in.
Let me tell you something. We have some coaching leadership here, young coaches coming in as leaders. This guy, comparatively from a year ago, has made a huge difference.
It's easy to get behind a lot of things that you hear in terms of the optimism I referenced with Martin Perez, in terms of the things you see. Young players getting excited about being in the White Sox clubhouse and representing the team, because you hear he's an easy guy to trust.
I totally agree.
He's an easy guy to like.
Yeah.
He's got a personality. He's got a capability. He's got all the things that you want to see in a young manager. He's only 42 years old. The former player thing is big, especially in that clubhouse. They respect him.
It's also nice to talk to managers and coaches that are smarter than you.
Yeah.
always makes you feel better. You sometimes talk to someone and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Let's take an IQ test. Don't be mean. All right. We got Dan Wiederer will join us next. He's down at the owner's meeting.
And if he's busy, we have some interesting audio from George McCaskey talking about the tush push and how the Bears feel about that.
All right. Mully and Haw on the score.
Mornings with Mully and Haw on 670 The Score.
They have an open mic situation, and we spoke in support of banning the play.
In support of the Green Bay Packers.
I asked the membership not to let that get out, that I supported a proposal of Team Voldemort.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. That is George McCaskey talking about he whose name should not be mentioned.
Yes, the Green Bay Packers were the lead team in opposing the tush push and wanting it banned. Before we get to Dan Wiederer, George McCaskey explained in detail why he opposed this to the extent that he did.
We supported the proposal to get rid of it.
How come?
Health and safety. I know they say that we don't have sufficient injury data on it. But to us, it appears to be an inherently unsafe play. I had the opportunity during committee meetings here earlier in the month to sit in the back of the room for the Health and Safety Committee meeting, and both Dr. Alan Sills and Dr. John York expressed concerns about the safety of everybody involved in that play. And, you know, for decades, there was a rule on the books making it illegal to push the runner. And it went away in 2004, and I always wondered why that happened. And Rich McKay, the chairman of the competition committee, explained to us yesterday that the officials said that it was too difficult when there was like a moving scrum down the field to determine whether an offensive lineman was blocking or pushing the runner. So they took it out, which led to the push play. From what I understand yesterday, the discussion about the push play is going to lead to a broader examination of whether that general rule should be brought back. And again, we think it would be an enhancement to the game to make it safer for the players.
Mully and Haw, that of course is George McCaskey, and we are delighted to welcome in Dan Wiederer. He joins us from the owner meetings now on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, aturo.com. Dan, good morning. Thanks for jumping on.
Yeah, happy to do it. How are you guys?
Doing well. What do you think about George, what he said and how he said it?
Well, we had a lot of time with George, both in a group session and then in some side sessions. And it's been an action-packed morning here in Palm Beach with a lot to unpack. Are you speaking specifically of the tush push there, correct? Yeah. I mean, look, like this has been a spirited conversation all week here amongst people that are looking at this from a lot of different angles. The health and safety conversation attached to the play has been amplified this week. And then I think there's a competitive side to this where there's a lot of people around the league and even some within the Bears organization that say, look, like the Philadelphia Eagles found something that works really well for them. And it's the job of the other 31 teams to figure out how to do it as well and or stop it, you know, and come up with solutions to not make it be so effective. And so there's a reason the discussion got tabled until May, because there's a lot to it and there's a lot of opinions and it gets a little active in those rooms sometimes.
Dan, what stood out to you about anything that George said today? What was the headline in your head?
Yeah, you know, I think the two obvious topics of the morning are the progress on the stadium and where that's going. You get this sense that Arlington Heights is, you know, to use a horse racing analogy, now kind of a neck ahead, you know, and closing down the back stretch there with Phil George F trying to get him across the wire there. The other part of this is obviously the conversation about the future of Bears ownership is central to a lot of people's thought processes now. And George has been vocal in expressing confidence in the succession plan that his mother laid out, a succession plan that the league has approved. And then there's also an acknowledgement that, like all family plans, there's usually a spirited debate about those as well. And so I think that's going to be the dynamic that the McCaskey family has to sort through in the coming months and years to figure out exactly who's all on board. And if some folks aren't on board, how do we address that? How do we deal with that? How do we come to a family resolution on a very high stakes decision?
So Kevin Warren said to Mike Florio yesterday that Arlington Heights seemed feasible for a lot of reasons, but it seemed like what he was doing was opening the door or reopening it wider to that possibility of getting shovels in the ground, maybe at the 326 acres they own sooner rather than later. It would seem that George McCaskey, reminding people that George Halas had this idea this morning of building Arlington Heights, doubled down on that notion. How soon do you think this could all come together, Dan?
Well, Kevin then tripled down on it in the group session with the Chicago media today, saying that, look, like there's urgency to this and that he expects to have dirt being moved around in this calendar year. And look, like there's economic dynamics to this stuff as well. And so the layers of this are pretty deep. And, you know, to hear Kevin talk today about the weekly fluctuations of tariff conversations and how those impact some of the things that you need to do in construction. Right. And so there's a lot that's fluid, a lot that is happening every single week that complicate this, but it sure feels like they are making efforts to get a shovel in the ground. And it feels like all the momentum right now is again, pushing towards that 326 acres out near my house.
Yeah, I got to tell you, when you point out that George Halas, the founder of the team, oh, he always wanted it. That is basically, oh, we got to follow what George Halas wanted. I just don't know. Hearing Kevin yesterday talking to Pro Football Talk, it feels like, you know, you still would love to do the downtown stadium, but there isn't enough support to get that done. They're going to wind up in Arlington Heights.
It feels that way. It sure does. Yeah. And obviously there was a mayoral election there last night. And so that, you know, you have to engage new people in the discussions. You have to bring people up to speed. You got to continue to, I guess, modify and strengthen your lobbying efforts in Springfield to get what you need. And you know, all that stuff will be happening in real time here in the near future.
How much do you think, going to the football part of it now, Ben Johnson speaking this week to everybody, it seems, when he talked about converting, and that I think is the right word, converting Caleb Williams from a shotgun quarterback to somebody who is behind center.
Yes.
How big of a project is that, Dan? And how much of is it at all a departure from fitting your offense around the skill sets of the people there to kind of making Caleb Williams into something he hasn't been?
So, David, it's partially in a project, but it's partially an experiment, because I think Ben was very forward in saying, if we get to the end of the spring and we see that like this just doesn't work for Caleb, we're not going to be stubborn and try to force this on him. At the same time, he feels very, very strongly that not only his offense, but many offenses around the NFL be at their most potent when they have an under center running game that then creates play action opportunities that then makes life easier on a quarterback. And so that's it's a great question, because this is as big of a priority as the Bears have on their spring slate, is to have Ben and Caleb unite and figure out a way to get comfortable together. And that's step one, is like, here's the under center game. Here's what we're asking you to do with it. Can you do it? Can you handle it? Can you be, as Ben said in January, comfortable being uncomfortable for a little bit, and then get into that zone where now you can unlock things for the offense and for yourself as a quarterback. So yeah, it's a big deal here over the next 3 or 4 months as they try to get that thing off the ground.
Dan, what was your take on hearing that Braxton Jones is going to be limited because of the ankle surgery? And then, and by the way, we want him to add more weight, which are two contrary things, recovering from ankle surgery and then putting more weight. It makes you wonder if their draft plan has to include not replacing him, but adding someone to compete with him. How's that?
Right. And look, like Karan Amagaji's name was brought up a couple times this week. I think that there are going to be open eyes here over the next month as the Bears finalize their draft board. And I've really been talking a lot here recently about the collection of four picks, you know, like the focus is on number 10, but you have those two second rounders, you have the other one in the early 70s, and you're going to explore for the potential of adding a guy there that can be a starter on your offensive line. Like you're going to give that every possible look. And if it doesn't happen, you have contingency plans and you feel okay about what you have there. But that's certainly after the strengthening of the interior of the offensive line, that is the one piece on up front that is still remaining to be really locked in. And you got the sense from Ben Johnson, you got the sense from Ryan Poles that they have to continue looking into upgrading there and figuring out what their best plan of attack will be going forward. And obviously they get an opportunity to do that in about 3 weeks.
As Ryan Poles spoke about the depth that exists from pretty much from after 10 through as deep as maybe 50 or 60,
yeah,
and we've also heard, you know, there's very little difference, or there's not a wide of a gap between 15 and maybe 45. Did that sound like a general manager trying to suggest that he's capable of, or maybe even likely to trade down? Do you think that he wants that message out there, and how likely would that be?
Well, in order to trade down, you have to have somebody that wants to trade up. And when the widespread sentiment in the league is that you've got that sweet spot that Ryan mentioned between really about like 6 and 70, where you feel like it's very comparable in terms of the quality of talent there, you may not have a lot of suitors coming up to come get something. I do think that Ryan feels like this draft, with the picks that they have in the top 75 and the needs that they have matched up with what's available in the draft, he sees this as a golden opportunity. And they really feel like on those first 2 days of the draft, they can accomplish something. And so, you know, it's time to keep that momentum turning forward. We all know how successful they felt they were in March, and April's the next step of getting some of those pieces locked in, and they're going to explore the draft for every possible option.
I thought it was really interesting when Ben Johnson talked about roster construction, saying that you don't want 5'6" guys necessarily in the receiver room, and you need, it's like a basketball team, you need different skill sets. I find that combined with the comment about the passing game EPA being a more impressive, a more important statistic than turnover margin, which I think we thought was hugely important, and it still is. But I thought those two comments, it makes you wonder what exactly they're looking at those positions. And I'll include tight end in that, Dan. So you're just looking for little crumbs leading to the draft.
Yeah, they've been dropping a lot of crumbs this week, and it's been really valuable as someone on the beat to kind of get that ability to learn what the vision is. And you heard Ryan say in February that when you have a clear vision, it allows you to be more aggressive. And that applied to free agency, but it applies going forward, because when Ben Johnson talks about EPA, he also links that up with run after catch.
Yes.
And when he talks about run after catch, he also links that up with having a guy or multiple guys who can be really impactful from the slot. And so now you start to see some of the vision crystallize, and you start to see, okay, these are some of the things that they're seeking. Can they get it done in one offseason? Do they need multiple offseasons? How does this look? Do you take guys like DJ Moore and Rome Odunze and modify their roles so that they give you more run after catch? Do you use a free agent signing like Zacchaeus and turn him into a more of a weapon? What do you find in the draft? And so, those breadcrumbs have all taken us down a path. And you start to get an understanding of what Ben's after here. And now it's Ryan's job to go get what Ben's after. And then it's their job to put those pieces in position to have offensive success.
Before we let you go, Dan, did you feel like Ben Johnson spoke like a coach that when he was referencing Detroit 1-2 running back with Gibbs and Montgomery, did he sound like a guy enamored with Ashton Jeanty at number 10?
It's hard to decipher that right now. What I will tell you this on a bigger picture level about Ben Johnson speaking like a coach is that like the presence and passion that he exudes in every conversation is really, really palpable. It was evident all week. And you get the sense that this is a head coach whose competitive edge is going to connect with Chicago very quickly. Success has to follow. The results have to follow on the field. But you're going to get a guy that a lot of people in this city want to root for and want to rally behind. And that was present here this week. It was in when Ben was talking. It was when Kevin, George, and Ryan were talking about Ben. There's an energy that the Bears are trying to capitalize on here. And I think they can do it, because I think that Ben does bring what Kevin Warren referred to as panache to the table. And so they're going to have to lean into that a little bit as they go forward.
Love that word.
All right. Great stuff, Dan. Thanks a ton for everything.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Dan.
It.
Always good to join you guys. Talk soon.
That's Dan Wiederer.
He's got panache.
Yeah.
It's a good word.
Panache. Panache.
It's panache. Panache.
Yeah.
You say tomato, I say tomato.
Spud. Okay. We've got to talk to our colleagues. We've got to... We first have to give something away.
We will give something away right now. You could be the sixth caller to the Scores Contest line at 312-540-0670, and you can win tickets to the Jordan Davis Ain't Enough Road Tour with special guests Mitchell Tenpenny and Vincent Mason. It's Friday, October 10th at Allstate Arena in Rosemont. Tickets are available if you don't win at Ticketmaster.com, but call now and win, 312-540-0670.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.